This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Professor Beatrice Operlu, who obtained her PhD in environmental toxicology. She is a full professor in environmental chemistry and toxicology and an established researcher who is C3 rated. She's published over 120 articles in peer-reviewed journals, book chapters, and conference proceedings across the discipline of environmental chemistry and environmental toxicology. She is the immediate past president of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry in Africa, and she mentors many environmental science practitioners in academia, business, and government. She was also the convener of CETAC, the Africa Women's Event, and the co-convener of Empower Her NG and Empower Her SA, which we will talk more about in the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amalia. It's a privilege and an honor to be your guest. Thank you for the invitation.
We haven't had many people in your discipline on the show. In fact, I think you're probably the only person in the toxicology space who's come on board. So can you tell us about your journey into environmental toxicology and what initially inspired you to get into this field?
You know, Dr. Malka, thank you so much. You just added to another first for me today. Yes, indeed. I'm not surprised that you've never had a woman in my field and on your show before now. I'm actually the first student that graduated in that program in my university. The first in the undergraduate, the first for my master, for my PhD. And of course, the first from Africa that will lead a society, a global organization, the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. So I initially, when I wanted to start my degree, I wanted to study chemistry. And I wasn't qualified for chemistry because I didn't have what they called O-level physics. Even though I did physics at my diploma level and I passed really well, I thought that should count for an O-level equivalent. But because, you know, the structures of our curriculum and the laws and the rules, I was excluded. And I was offered this new program that was just starting at the time, Environmental Management and Toxicology, and I was clueless about the program. I didn't want to accept it because I wanted chemistry. But I was lucky to have someone that was a role model and mentor to me at the time, Professor Joe at the time. He said, no, but Tony is my home name. You must accept this. This is a new thing in the US now. Environment is a big deal. Go for it. And I checked the curriculum of the program. I thought there were many chemistry subjects there. And so I thought, okay, why not? So that was how I accepted the course. So I really didn't choose to study environmental management and toxicology. They chose it for me. The system chose it for me. But I'm glad that I accepted the guidance I received and I accepted the faith that was birthed for me because the rest is history today. So that is how I found myself there. But then by my fourth year of the program, I started getting exposed to field work. The first time they took me to the landfill site, I thought, okay, I mean, a refuse dump, not really a landfill, it was a refuse dump. Then I started connecting with the relevance of whatever I was studying at the time. And that was when the interest started. And then they would take me to a national reserve to see the trees and, you know, the animals and everything, how it's been conserved, the reasons for those. And so all those exposures, I think they assisted in stirring up my interest. And that was when I really think, okay, maybe it's a good thing that I accepted. I have no regrets. I'm actually grateful that I was offered that course.
When you were talking, I was reflecting how the environment and climate change is such a big deal now, and your mentor had identified that trend way back.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when we see this flooding of the coastal areas, the hurricanes, the thunderstorm, the floods in KZN, I tell people, but this is what I was taught in the early 90s. Then there were predictions. We were not even sure, but now there's data outside there about climate change and the issues that will come around there. And so sometimes it bothers me. Sometimes I feel frustrated when people still deny the reality of climate change because it's here now. All the predictions of over 20 years ago, they are now coming, and it's not going to get better if we don't prepare to mitigate some of those issues.
You've been very pioneering in the work that you do in your personal transformations. And if I think even physical geographic changes from Nigeria to South Africa. But thinking about women in science, we tend to be underrepresented in the discipline. And as someone who is highly accomplished, who's attained her professorship, what are some of the challenges that you've experienced as a woman, both in academia, but also in environmental research? And importantly, how did you overcome them?
I don't even know where to start. Whether as a younger scientist, thirsty for growth and hungry for, achievements and just doing what I should do to be where I needed to be, or whether as a leader myself, as I grew older and, climb the ladder in academics is a lot. So as a young woman, you want opportunities. You look at other people ahead of you that can hold your hand. But my experience was that many of those women that were ahead of us at the time, they would rather keep information that was not useful to them because of the age caps in their drawers, rather than giving it out to the younger women. I was privileged and honored to be supervised by an amazing woman for my master's degree, and she actually called my attention to that. And the first conference that I attended was with her. I didn't have transport money, I didn't have accommodation. I slept in his house on his bed, just because she was keen, Professor Fadinona, to hold my hand. And we got to this meeting. It was a women, they call it Gender and Science and Technology Conference in Abuja 2000. And I saw this keynote speaker, Professor Grace Alele Williams. She's now late. And I saw her, I thought, someday I want to be like that woman. And I got excited. And I went to these other aunties. And one auntie from Kenya handed me over to another auntie from Nigeria, connect this lady with us. But this Nigerian auntie never, just to give me the email address of these people. And that struck something in me then, and years later, that I'm never going to be this auntie. So there are things like that, there are issues like that, that women not willing to support other women, let's start from us. And there are other women willing, wanting to pull other women down. And of course, there's the fact that in the workplace itself, generally, the women, because you're a woman, you want to do extra, to prove a point that you are qualified, though there's this immense pressure that the system imposes on women. For example, if I'm the HOD now, I'm expected to be stand to be, but I'm a woman. I'm a woman, I'm allowed to be feminine. I'm allowed to hug my secretary as a woman because that's how I choose to lead. And doesn't mean I can't be assertive with my secretary when I need jobs done. It actually fosters more greater productivity because now she doesn't want to lose that opportunity with you, and she will work over the weekend to see the boss happy. And that was my experience anyway. So there are many challenges. And of course, there's this challenge of the workplace many times in, as I continue, even till now, there are times I'm the only woman there that has a voice. And most times the voice, because other people don't see the perspective you are coming from, certain things have been normalized in the system, like if you're a woman, then you are automatically the secretary of the department, even if there are younger people that could take the notes. That's just an example. So, but for me, one of the things that helped me is that I have always known myself. I don't get the definition the system or other people know me for. So I always try to be authentic to myself, no matter how horrible it seems outside to other people, no matter how insensible it seems to them. So I'm authentic first to myself because that is where I'm coming from. You will see me mentioning by God's grace because that is where I'm anchored. That is my safe space. And I'm unapologetic about it. When I present, I do my thing. So it's a whole lot of issues around being a woman in that in the space that we operate from. And we can talk about this for many hours.
One of the things that you mentioned, linking into what you've just said, is self-authenticity. And we spoke about that offline. And you were talking about the fact that if you can't be authentic to yourself, you can't show up authentically to anybody else.
You can't. You have to be authentic, true to yourself, true to your context, true to your faith, true to where you belong. I'm an African, and I'm authentically African. I want to be seen as African. I'm a woman. I have to be true to that. I'm a Christian. I have to be true to that. I can't be this person here and the other person there. So it's one of the reasons why I don't shy away from taking responsibilities. When I think I'm wrong, I will say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, even to my children or younger people. And if I think I'm right, I would say, no, but this is what I think for A, B, C, and D. And if I think in the space I am, there's an unfairness, we have to speak about it because that's how I truly feel. And if I don't express it that way, not in an unkind way, I have to caution because there's a way to put things across in a cruel manner in the name of being authentic and being objective. Those are not synonyms. So authenticity is very key. It's very key.
And I would imagine that that aspect of authenticity has led to some of the projects that you've developed and that you've been interested in. So, for example, you've got a broad range of research interests from wastewater remediation to green chemistry and sustainable agricultural systems. Could you tell us about a relatively recent project that excites you and also the potential impact of it?
Oh, thank you so much. Most of my work has always been in imaging contaminants, and I tell people, okay, I imagine with contaminants. So there are these contaminants we know as legacy contaminants, the heavy metals, you know, nitrates and nutrients and all of those. But there are others that I imagine because not because they were not there, but for many reasons. We didn't know their full implications. We couldn't measure them at the levels they occur in the environment and things. But now we have the capacity and we have seen that they are problematic, like pharmaceutical residues, for example, in waters like the PFOS and PFAS and the ones the glaze the pores and that we get exposed to, you know, phenolic compounds and all of those. And it's always exciting to me to say, okay, this is the also I jump from one emerging contaminant to other. But what we do most times is to develop methods for quantifying them. When we develop those methods, we now use the methods to quantify them in real environmental samples, water samples, wastewater samples, drinking water samples, river systems, and food matrices sometimes, trying to see how processing affects this, all of this. But one of the latest one I did that was exciting to me was the microplastics and water systems that we did. So you might have known issues with plastics all over the world, and there are even indications that some of these things can migrate into the neural system, the brain, and interfere with the way we behave and act. So we did this project. There were two projects, one focused on two river systems and the other on wastewater systems, funded by the Water Research Commission of South Africa. I'm grateful to them, and also the National Research Foundation. Now, we trained a couple of students on those projects. The long and short story of the project is that we could establish that in all of the samples we worked with, there were microplastics, meaning people are exposed to microplastic in some way if they get exposed to those things. Some of those waters from the wastewater treatment plants get recycled. We may be exposed also if something is not done further to purify. The striking one for me is that organisms have the ability to adapt. We could see that there's probably the opportunity for adaptation for organisms, which gives me hope as a human being that perhaps the rise may not be too physiologically stressful for me after a while if I'm able to survive it. But the sad part is that some people will die. So what this means for me again is that more work needs to be done in terms of climate change resilience in preparation for the woes that will befall the world. Like I mentioned earlier on, these were predictions about a decade, about 2, 3 decades ago, but we have lots of data now showing that these things are already happening and other things will still happen. Past the threshold already, and so we just have to be preparing, because it doesn't seem that nations are willing or committed to reversing the trend. So I would say adaptation, resilience strategies, and other things in using science and social science. I think I cannot oversize the interdisciplinary approach to climate change mitigation and adaptation strategies more than now. We need all of the disciplines to come on board to put in some cool stuff. So the microplastics in the environment is the latest one I did, and I think it has implications for future use.
Dovetailing off of what you've just said in the microplastics work that you've done, we as people can never see to the level of the microscopic in a glass of water. It looks clean. And I think that that's also part of the challenge. When you can't see something, you don't necessarily think that there's anything wrong with it. But ensuring that there are appropriate safety standards and measures and that industries adhere to qualities is so important, not just in the industry that is in under question or interest, but also protecting people, protecting agriculture and the country at large. I know that you serve on the National Technical Committees at the South African Bureau of Standards. Can you please tell us how scientific research can improve on developing policy and industry practices so that we have the right safety measures in place and importantly, that industries are compliant?
I always tell people that I can speak of South Africa, and Nigeria now has one of the most beautiful laws and rules in terms of safety and protecting consumers and all of those. Sometimes it's the implementation that is the issue. Sometimes it's not altogether the industry. Sometimes it's also lifestyle issues. The consumers themselves, the citizens themselves. And sometimes it's the value chain. And I will give you example using water also. We did a research some years back right here in South Africa. We tried to see if phenolic compounds were in the potable water, the drinking water that we drink. And we picked up a few in some of the waters. But the phenolic compounds were not necessarily added from where it was coming from. So the plastics that is being used has phenolic compounds in them that should ideally say in the bottle, not leached into the water. But when these bottles get exposed to sunlight, the UV lights, acts on them and they become leached into what we drink. So it's the value chain in that sense. Therefore, because of some of the studies I've done and some of the outcomes and all of those, and my exposure also to other spaces outside of academia, is to say, listen here, this issue of human health issues, environmental health issues, and environmental sustainability issues is no longer us versus them. It's no longer researchers versus industry, industry versus government. We are all in it together. Because whether I'm in the industry or not, I need to drink water. My children need to drink water. Whether I'm a researcher or not, I have family that is earning from the plastic industry, socioeconomic aspect of the business. Whether you're government or not, you need funds from taxes. So we have to come together. What is it? How can we do these trade-offs in a way? One of the things that we joke about in my field is that everything is a potential poison, given the time and the amount. If you drink too much water, for example, perhaps you can have edema, for example, as good as water is. So everything is a potential poison. So we can't, I mean, plastic, for example, plastic is bad, but it's also good. And, the things that happens now, always remind me of my first scientific essay that I did in my undergraduate. Technology is a blessing as well as a curse. It's just the same thing today. Plastics are in the laptop now, on your MacBooks. Plastic is everywhere. Perhaps banning plastics altogether is not the answer to answer socioeconomic questions. Perhaps it's just using plastics in other ways than single-use plastics, then in the facial scrub. Perhaps we have to rethink how we use plastics and not necessarily banning it altogether. So for me, what we need to do is to have multi-sectoral kind of interventions. So the scientists come on board, government is there, industry is there, and we all sit down, have these dialogues, and design projects together that can work for everybody. So I'm a firm believer of sustainability in different dimensions, especially because I'm African. And I know that Africa is at disadvantaged because of the global environmental issues we have now. I mean, we are not the greatest carbon emitters. So why must my grandmother in the village be told not to pay certain amount for a cheaper version of because of environmental issue? So there have to be trade-offs here and there amongst countries, among individuals, among sectors. So I would suggest multi-sectoral to start with us in Africa. We need to work more with each other across sectors in the environmental space.
It's certainly a complex value chain, and thinking it from almost like from conceptualization to end of life and that sustainability dynamic and the multi-sectoral point. I wanted to touch on one of the aspects that you mentioned in terms of Africa being at a disadvantage. So, in thinking about aspects of climate change and women in particular, what are some of your views regarding gender and vulnerability to climate change in the continent?
Let me start from gender-based violence. There was a study, I can't remember the year now it was published, that men, African men especially, they get more aggressive when temperature rises. So in hot temperatures, they're more likely to be aggressive. And I can relate to that, not because I got aggressive partner, but when the temperature is not right, I struggle to be productive. And who are the ones that are mostly vulnerable to this action? It's women. Let's start from there. So gender-based violence is more likely to rise in Africa. I'm not saying it will, Because if we put in interventions now, then perhaps it will not, like, educating our children, our sons, and all of those, and our men in the communities are listening. Temperature can do this to you physiologically, but you don't have to respond that way. So women will be more prone to violence in their homes by their spouses. That is the first one. There are other things that is endless. Like, for example, who are the carers in the house? Who are the ones that fetch water? Who are the ones that cook? All of this require water. They need water to do all of this. Who will stress to get water when water becomes even more scarce than it is now? So it's the women. And when we talk about parents having to choose because there will be dwindling resources, loss of livelihoods because of flooding, because agricultural lands are being lost, crops are being washed away, and other things, and diseases, and all of those. Who are the people in Africa, especially, that fathers will prioritize to invest their money on? It's the boys, not the girls, because the girls will go marry. And the family legacy goes with the marriage, whereas the male child is perceived to carry on the marriage. So the girl child becomes more predisposed to opportunities. It's lesser opportunities for the girl child. And of course, the issue of trafficking because of poverty. And of course, there's the issue of people not being able to do what they should do because of the burden of this. Sicknesses. In my community, there's a saying that the person that is sick is not the sick person. The person that is taking care of the sick person is the one that is actually sick because he's the one that will go fetch the medication, nurse the person, do all of those, and then you will probably also develop a sickness. So it's a whole lot of issues. When parents want to decide who do I pay for their education now, it's not going to be the girl child. So the dropout rate of girl child, not necessarily because they don't want to go to school, not necessarily because they have teenage pregnancies, not necessarily because they can't perform in school or succeed, the burden comes on the girls again. They become dropouts because families cannot afford to put all their children in school at the same time. So it's a whole lot of things burden on women when if climate change continues in this trajectory, and it's really scary, I must say. It's really scary. So we need to be prepared.
Wow, Prof, there's never a simple solution to any of this.
No.
You were talking about some of the deficits that girls face purely because they're a girl, born a girl, and never mind the climate change aspects, but that they often may be denied an education. You have mentored many students over the years. Can you tell us why mentorship in your field is so important, and also what advice you have for young women pursuing careers in STEM?
Mentorship is very important because you don't necessarily, a younger person don't necessarily have to go through the rough patches that we went through. But mentorship has done a lot for me. And one of the things that I think helped me in my career, especially, is the opportunity to have good mentors. And by good mentors, they don't necessarily have to be, they didn't necessarily have to be my supervisors, because I knew where I wanted to be, and I knew the strengths of my supervisors, and I knew my supervisors wouldn't provide that guidance and support that I needed. So I needed mentors outside of them, and that was what I did. So you need mentors, whoever they be, they may be for to younger ones. And as I continue to grow, I find my mentors in different spaces depending on what I need. But what I can add on to this is a level above mentorship is sponsors. We need sponsors over and above the mentors. The mentors will guide you, they will tell you do A, B, C, and D. But the sponsors will mention you in rooms where you don't have a voice.
Prof Opeolu, Sponsors are not talked about enough. Share with us how we can get the momentum going. And when I say not talked about enough, I think maybe in the 12 years of hosting this program, it's come across maybe three times out of over 500 conversations.
Because those are hard to find. They are very rare. So people can mentor you for different reasons. Sometimes people mentor out of, we need to tick boxes to say, oh, I mentored two Black South Africans. Other people, and again, authenticity. So some people will mentor you because they genuinely care about your growth. And those are the ones that end up being your sponsors. And perhaps it's good to mention one of those in my career this afternoon. She's one that I call my tribe. She's Getty Arts from the Wageningen University, the Netherlands, an amazing mentor. We met in my professional space, the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. You know, she's this amazing. So we've done a couple of things together in the CITAC Africa Women's Event. I mean, she nominated me for the first award I ever got from CITAC. Not any of my other mentors, not any of my African mentors, not anybody from Africa. So I became the first African to obtain the CITAC Fellows Award, thanks to this amazing woman. And she will mention you in spaces where you are not. Those are sponsors. Those are sponsors. And she will not mind it doing a second and a third time. We need more of those. And that is the kind of mentor I want to be. For anybody at all, I decide to be their mentor. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. That is what really opens the doors for people and gives them that endorsement to go on to greater opportunities. Prof, we're running out of time today. A question for me that's always really important, and given all of your experience, is if you can tell us about some of the factors that you feel have contributed to your success.
Let me start from my late mom. She was a cleaner in the hospital for many years. Looking back in time, I'm actually grateful that she had that opportunity in the first place, because at least they could gather some money to pay her school fees. And this woman will always tell me, three generations cannot be poor, in my language. I cannot be cleaning the floor and my child continues that. So you have to have education. That was the first one. Always, she will always say that. And at some point, she decided to go to school to train as a community health officer when she was already a grandmother. I already had my first son then. And I looked at her that year. I just finished my undergraduate. And I said, if this woman can do this, then I needed the highest level. So I thought I would have my PhD that day. And that was it. So she was that first person that motivated me. And, you know, I thought I could do it if she did it. And then I have this amazing aunt. She's older now and she lives in California with my cousin. Every time she visited in the village, it was blessing. It was happiness. Everybody was happy because she had some education. And so her life is different from other siblings that didn't have education. So as a young child in the village, I understood that education will make a difference in my life. And then my dad's cousins, the ones that had small little education, you know, teachers' college and all of those, I saw that their lives were different from my dad. My dad was also a forklift driver in the company. So I understood that education, and it's still the same thing today. So I have these amazing people. And then as I grew older, I have my other things that kept me going, kept me focused. So I was always focused on the target, the PhD. And I think at some point my dad asked me, when will you finish? I told him after my PhD. And so I was really focused. I didn't care about the money. I became a not an irresponsible child, because I'm the first child of seven siblings that should be supporting a poor family. But I couldn't, because I was focused on using my resources to obtain my PhD. I didn't have the resources to support my family when I should. But the good news is that the story has changed today. I could support as much as I could. They need my support now because of education. And I always tell people, education for a poor person, for a poor child that comes from a family like mine, is the shortest key out of poverty. Even despite everything that is happening, whether it's unemployment or whatever opportunities you don't have, if you have your education, you can use the skills you obtained in your education to make some money and live well with your family. So I think let me just drop it there.
What a success. And I mean that in so many ways of transformation, of changing your life, of changing other people's lives through focus and education. And lastly, as we close out today's conversation, please share a few words of inspiration for women and girls that are listening to us on the continent.
I would say the first thing is the God factor. As crazy as I seem to many people in terms of many of the decisions I take, I seldom take big decisions without the God factor in it. I will always go to my safe place, which is my faith, and I believe everybody should have that safe space, whatever that means to you, where when it gets crazy outside, it gets hectic, you can always return to and find your new peace and strength to continue. So I will always have that peace of mind that this step I'm taking, God is going with me. So it doesn't matter what I will face there. I know that I will navigate it. And it always works every time. So I will say my advice based on my personal experience is that young ones, put the God factor in your journey, whatever it is. And the other one is that you have to be self-authentic. You have to be true to yourself. It doesn't matter what the society expects of you. It doesn't matter what your family expects of you. It doesn't even matter what your parents or your children expect of you. You have to be true to yourself. If my children expect me to give them this much at the end of the month, is it something I can afford? If I can't afford it, I need to let them know. And I believe that if we've been true to each other, we've been transparent with each other, most times it's easy to navigate. At least from my personal experience, when people know how much your children know how much you earn and we need to do A, B, C, and D, what's more? I'm also somebody, I need this much for these other things. So be authentic, because that's how you can attain the fullness of your potential. Refuse to be boxed. Not by yourself, not by others. If I wanted to be boxed by myself, I wouldn't leave the university to start BCS Hive, because I already thought as I was continuing my journey that I would retire as a full-time professor in the university. But at some point, I felt I'm now in a box. I felt there's need to do more, and I wouldn't be able to do those as a full-time professor in the university. So what did I need to do? I needed to reappraise. So every time you reappraise, you reevaluate your context. There are times I could leave babies to go pursue a master's degree in another town. There was a time I couldn't leave for my sabbatical because I had a daughter that was writing my trek. So you have to reappraise. There's time to do these radical things and just go. There are times you have to do other, you have to be more considerate of other things. So depending on what will work for you best at every point in time in your career, be authentic, just be true to yourself. That would be my piece of advice. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed our conversation today. It's been a pleasure to host you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program and a honor to be among one of those guests, esteemed guests. I saw the guest list. I mean, I feel honored. Thank you so much for giving me this platform to air my view to your listeners. Thank you and God bless you too.
Thanks again. You have been listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, and we have been talking to Professor Beatrice Opeolu, who specializes in environmental toxicology.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.